Climate Change the Facts. Experts as Ideologues by James Dellingpole. James Dellingpole is the executive editor for the London branch of Breitbart.com, author of Watermelons, How Environmentalists Are Killing the Planet, Destroying the Economy, and Stealing Your Children's Future, published in Australia as Killing the Earth to Save It. A good many times I've been present at gatherings of people who, by the standards of the traditional culture, are thought highly educated, and who have, with considerable gusto, have been expressing their incredulity at the illiteracy of scientists. Once or twice I've been provoked and have asked the company how many of them could describe the second law of thermodynamics. The response was cold. It was also negative. Yet I was asking something which is the scientific equivalent of, "Have you read a work of Shakespeare's?" C.P. Snow. Whenever someone wants to demonstrate beyond all reasonable doubt that an evil, climate change denying, kitten strangling, big oil funded ignoramus like James Dellingpole has nothing useful whatsoever to contribute to the debate on global warming, what they usually ask is this: what are his scientific qualifications? Well, I'll come clean now and admit that mine are close to zero. Sure, I did once grow copper sulfate crystals in a chemistry lesson. Yes, I believe I may once have dissected a frog, granted. I do actually possess a grade B in physics O level. But my university education was in the arts, not the sciences. I have an MA in English Language and Literature from Oxford, which many of the trolls who lurk beneath my climate change blog seem to think is damning evidence of my unutterable stupidity. And perhaps they're right. One of the most disturbing things I've noticed during my years in the climate war's trenches is the quite terrifying correlation between possession of an English literature degree and off-the-scale ignorance about the environment. Take, for example, Roger Harabin, the BBC environment analyst who so tirelessly bigs up every eco-scare going. Guess what he read at Cambridge? And Caroline Lucas, Britain's first Green MP, who once claimed, in all seriousness, that flying on holiday was as bad as knifing someone in the street, because people are, quote, dying from climate change. Any idea what her specialist field might have been at university? And what about Tamsin Ormond, the Westminster-educated baronet's granddaughter turned hardcore activist who once dumped a truckload of horse poo on Jeremy Clarkson's doorstep in protest at his environmental incorrectness? Or Bryony, now Baroness Worthington, the activist from hard-left environmental group Friends of the Earth, who was the architect of the most expensive and pointless green legislation in British parliamentary history, the 2008 Climate Change Act, which commits Britain to spend over £18 billion a year, every year till 2050, quote, decarbonizing its economy. Or Tim Flannery, who must be a clever fellow. With just a doctorate in kangaroo paleontology, he managed to land a job as Australia's climate commissioner, which paid, in Australian dollars, $180,000 a year, for a three-day week, all courtesy of the Aussie taxpayer. Go on, have a stab. Your starter for 10? What was Flannery's undergraduate degree at La Trobe University? Sorry, no prizes. I gave you the answer already, and I hope you find it as puzzling as I do. These people, they're forever invoking the scientific consensus on global warming, and saying we should trust the experts at the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and at learned institutions like the Commonwealth Scientific and Industrial Research Organization and the Royal Society. But what special knowledge are these English literature graduates bringing to the party that enables them to make these ex cathedra pronouncements as to who we should and shouldn't trust? An ability to make a passable modern language translation of Beowulf? A deep insight into the nature of patriarchy in Georgian England, with special reference to Emma and Pride and Prejudice? The fact of their having almost understood some bits of James Joyce's Ulysses? All that being said, it's really not my intention here to mock people with English literature degrees in particular, or non-scientists in general. On the contrary, my purpose in this chapter is to demonstrate that they are in some ways better qualified to contribute to the climate change debate than your average scientist. There are two main reasons for this. One is that in the last 30 years or so, the science on climate has become so systematically corrupted that the supposed experts propounding it can no longer be trusted. And the other is that the debate about climate is, and always has been, one which has far more to do with ideology, rhetoric, and propaganda than it does with the how many angels can dance on the head of a pin argument over the extent to which man-made CO2 emissions may or may not be altering global mean temperatures by fractions of a degree. But it's amazing how many otherwise well-informed, intelligent people still don't get this. Here, for example, is Washington Post columnist Michael Gerson in a piece arguing that the ongoing reluctance of the U.S. public to grapple with global warming stems from an aversion to science. Quote, "The only possible answers come from science, and for non-scientists, this requires a modicum of trust in the scientific enterprise." Gerson is speaking here, I suspect, for an awful lot of people who haven't looked too closely into the global warming debate, but feel instinctively that this must be a scientific issue to be resolved by scientists rather than a political one in which anyone can offer an opinion. Perhaps you're one of them yourself. You'll have read the chapters by, say, Ian Plimer, Pat Michaels, or Bob Carter, and have gone, "Well, that all seems very reasonable. The experts have spoken, and the science is perfectly clear. What exactly is the problem?" The problem, unfortunately, is that scientists like Plimer, Michaels, and Carter are rarely heard outside niche publications such as this one, or specialist websites like What's Up With That. And this isn't because they're not credible witnesses. Each has scientific credentials as long as your arm. But in the crazy world of climate science, knowledge, experience, and real-world evidence count for less than being on message. That is, if you support the so-called consensus on man-made global warming, then academic tenure, prizes, lavish grants, and favorable interviews by Robin Williams on the ABC are guaranteed. But if you don't, your destiny is to be cast into outer darkness and dismissed as anti-science or a denier. Consider what happened to Bob Carter when, shortly after the release of the latest IPCC assessment report by Working Group 1 in September 2013, he was interviewed by the BBC's lunchtime radio program, World at One. Quote, "Climate has always changed, and it always will. There is nothing unusual about the modern magnitudes or rates of change of temperature, of ice volume, of sea level, or of extreme weather events," he said. Not unreasonably or inaccurately, for there is a host of data to support every one of these claims. So how did the climate alarmist establishment respond? As it always does, with a stream of personal abuse. John Ashton, a former top climate change official at the Foreign Office, was given space in The Guardian to declare that the decision to give airtime to Carter was, quote, "a betrayal of the editorial professionalism on which the BBC's reputation has been built over generations." Geneticist Steve Jones, who in 2011 wrote a report for the BBC arguing that it should give less airtime to climate skeptics, said that inviting Carter to give his views represented, quote, "false balance," and was a bit like inviting a homeopath to speak alongside a brain surgeon. This view was supported at government ministerial level by Greg Barker, a conservative, surprisingly, who said, "I am not trying to ban all dissenting voices, but we are doing the public a disservice by treating them as equal, which is not the case." Bob Ward of the Grantham Research Institute on Climate Change and the Environment described it as a, quote, "stunning display of false balance." Note the key element missing from all this invective. Not once at any stage do any of Carter's critics attempt to address the substance of what he said. Why not? Because the facts as he stated them are incontrovertible. Climate has always changed. There have been periods in the pre-industrial past when temperatures have risen and fallen more rapidly and dramatically from natural causes than anything we have witnessed in this supposed age of catastrophic man-made global warming. The polar ice caps are not disappearing. Extreme weather has always been with us. Every day, somewhere in the world, another weather record is being broken because that's what weather does. Sea levels have been rising steadily at the same rate for at least the last 700 years, with no evidence of any alarming recent rise. What's going on here? In other words, has nothing whatsoever to do with, quote, "the science." This is propaganda, pure and simple. Various, apparently trustworthy authority figures have been invoked. The senior diplomat, the politician, the geneticist. the guy from the spiffy-sounding environmental think tank, to give the impression that when it comes to climate change, all the really serious people in the world are in full agreement. Only a handful of maverick dissenters, the message goes, now dispute the, quote, consensus, and only then because they are mad or stupid or in the pay of big oil. Before you dismiss this as a paranoid conspiracy theory, let me give you another example of this climate totalitarianism in action. This one involves Roger Pilkey, Jr., professor of environmental studies at the University of Colorado, Boulder. Pilkey, a self-described, quote, lukewarmer, that is, a believer in man-made global warming, sits fairly close to the middle of the climate change debate. Yet neither reasonableness, nor restraint, nor factual accuracy were enough to save his skin when in March 2014 he wrote a piece for the U.S. website 538 entitled, Disasters Cost More Than Ever, But Not Because of Climate Change. The points Pilkey made were unexceptionable. A big reinsurance company called Munich Re had published a report claiming the cost of dealing with climate disasters was increasing year on year. Pilkey replied, when you read that the cost of disasters is increasing, it's tempting to think that it must be because more storms are happening. They're not. All the apocalyptic, quote, climate porn in your Facebook feed is solely a function of perception. In reality, the numbers reflect more damage from catastrophes because the world is getting wealthier. We're seeing ever larger losses simply because we have more to lose. When an earthquake or flood occurs, more stuff gets damaged. And to back up this claim, Pilkey cited clear evidence from the most recent IPCC assessment report. For the climate alarmists, however, the truth is no defense. A series of attacks on Pilkey's credibility followed in The Guardian, in Columbia Journalism Review, in The Week, at George Soros' Think Progress, and also in the comments section below the post, such as this one by, quote, top commentator, Rob Honeycutt, which began, note to Nate Silver, I'm rather taken aback by this article by Roger Pilkey. It's just fundamentally wrong. Overwhelmed by the volume of criticism, Nate Silver, 538's editor-in-chief, decided to apologize for what Pilkey had written and to commission a rebuttal. You do wonder, though, whether he would have caved quite so easily had he been aware of this comment on a climate alarmist website called Skeptical Science, written in February 2011. Quote, I think this is a highly effective method of dealing with various blogs and online articles where these discussions pop up, flag them, discuss them, and then send in the troops to hammer down what are usually just a couple of very vocal people. It seems like lots of us are doing similar work, cruising comment sections online looking for disinformation to crush. I spend hours every day doing exactly this. If we can coordinate better and grow the team of crushers, then we could address all the anti-science much more effectively. The author of that comment was one Rob Honeycutt. If the name sounds vaguely familiar, just remind yourself who led the assault on Pilkey's article at 538. What he's advocating here is a technique known in the trade as astroturfing, where a relatively small number of committed activists are able to punch above their weight by giving the impression of being an extensive grassroots movement. Anyone who has ever spoken up publicly for the climate skeptic cause will be painfully familiar with these dirty trick tactics, not just astroturfing, but much uglier stuff like identity theft and false accusations, bullying and attempts at professional assassination. Some, such as the distinguished Swedish meteorologist Lennart Bengtsson, find the experience so dispiriting that they never do dare so again. In May 2014, Professor Bengtsson announced that he was to join the advisory board of the Global Warming Policy Foundation, a skeptical think tank founded by former British Chancellor of the Exchequer, Lord Lawson. It was a brave and principled move for Bengtsson, who had spent most of his long career specializing in climate modeling in the warmest camp. What changed his mind was the evidence. Recognizing the increasing divergence between the alarmist climate models and the real-world data, he realized that the consensus was flawed and that he could no longer support it. Just 3 weeks after taking the position, however, Bengtsson was forced to resign. He had been so badly bullied by his former colleagues, he wrote in his resignation letter, that his health was suffering and he was unable to work. Quote, it is a situation that reminds me about the time of McCarthy. I would never have expected anything similar in such an original peaceful community as meteorology. There is something rather charming about the innocence of that last statement, and it's a view, no doubt, that many people will fondly share. This idea that meteorologists, indeed, scientists generally, are a breed apart from the rest of humanity. Unlike, say, bankers or international footballers or businessmen, they are motivated not by vulgar concerns such as money or power, but purely by their disinterested quest for knowledge. One of the people responsible for this popular notion of scientists as a breed apart was the man I quoted at the beginning, C.P. Snow. Since his influential 1959 lecture, that myth has grown and grown, assiduously promoted by organizations like the BBC, which rarely lets a day go by without some new paean to the brilliance of the elect white lab-coated ones with their magical PhDs and their insights into the mysteries of the world which mere mortals cannot ken. Think how many newspaper articles begin with the phrase, quote, "scientists say." The implicit assumption being that whatever these guys say must be true because, well, they're scientists. Now, I certainly wouldn't wish to suggest that all scientists are frauds, but I do think that this modern reverence for the profession is not just overdone, but also potentially rather dangerous. Essentially, it's a version of the rhetorical fallacy known as the argumentum ad verecundium, the appeal to authority. No person or institution is infallible, neither a Nobel Prize-winning geneticist like Sir Paul Nurse, nor a scientific body as distinguished as the one of which he is president, the Royal Society, founded 1660. Indeed, it was in acknowledgement of this truth that for the first two centuries of the Royal Society's existence, its house journal, Philosophical Transactions, carried the following, quote, advertisement. It is an established rule of the Society to which they will always adhere never to give their opinion as a body upon any subject, either of nature or art, that comes before them. The reason for this was quite simple. Scientific knowledge is not fixed. If it were, if all nature's secrets were known, what would be the point of being a scientist? But what ought to be immediately obvious to anyone who ponders the logic is apparently anathema to the current climate establishment. From NASA, GISS, in the U.S., to the Climatic Research Unit in the University of Anglia, from the Royal Society, to the CSIRO, from the IPCC, to the UK Met Office, the official message is the same. The, quote, science on climate is, quote, settled. Only a handful of Fruit Loops, heretics, and right-wing ideologues now dispute the consensus on global warming. This is not science we're seeing in action here, but a form of political activism. One high-profile climate alarmist, the late Stephen Schneider, an IPCC lead author and professor of environmental biology and global change at Stanford University, came close to admitting this in an interview with Discover magazine. Quote, like most people, we'd like to see the world a better place, which in this context translates into our working to reduce the risk of potentially disastrous climate change. That, of course, entails getting loads of media coverage, so we have to offer up scary scenarios, make simplified, overdramatic statements, and make little mention of any doubts we might have. Charles Darwin would have disagreed. Quote, a scientific man ought to have no wishes, no affections, a mere heart of stone, he once said, and of course he is right. True science is about discovering what is, not what ought to be. It's about the rigorous application of the scientific method, which values free, open inquiry, embraces dissent, and stands or falls on empirical observation. This means, for example, that when a once plausible theory is falsified by real-world data, the theory becomes bunk, no matter what all the learned scientific institutions may claim to the contrary. Once you appreciate that much of what is going on in climate science is quintessentially unscientific, the viciousness of the debate makes a lot more sense. The quote, science is out there and has been for some time. Anthropogenic global warming theory is a busted flush. But instead of conceding the point to the opposition, an arrogant, dishonest, ruthless climate establishment continues to prop up its outmoded hypothesis by increasingly nefarious means. Like most of those who have engaged on behalf of the skeptical cause, I have bitter personal experience of these methods. A few years ago, a BBC producer wrote politely to ask whether I would appear in a documentary on global warming. The presenter, she promised me, had a completely open mind on the subject, and was anxious to consult my opinion because I was one of the journalists who had exposed the ClimateGate scandal. I happily consented, not least because the presenter was an impressive-sounding Nobel Prize-winning future head of the Royal Society called Sir Paul Nurse. Yes, with hindsight, I should have known better. It was, of course, intended all along as a hatchet job designed to discredit the cause of climate skepticism. Skeptics were bracketed in the same category as opponents to GM crops, and people who don't believe there's a connection between HIV and AIDS. And about the only section of the grueling four-hour interview with me they used was one in which Nurse tried to catch me out with a weird analogy. Being against the, quote, consensus on climate change, Nurse suggested, is the same as if you've got cancer, and instead of seeking treatment through mainstream medicine, you choose some alternative therapy quack cure. As a professional writer and polemicist, I have no problem in principle with analogies. I often use them myself when discussing the climate wars. For example, I have sometimes argued that the warmest establishment's desperate attempts to prop up its fatally flawed hypothesis is as absurd as if shortly after news began to break about the sinking of the Titanic, the ship's owners, the White Star Line, had held a press conference insisting that no, the Titanic was continuing to steam ahead to New York. The analogy works because that's pretty much exactly what is happening right now with mainstream climate science. All the models say one thing, the Titanic is unsinkable. The ship is sailing at so many knots on such and such a course, and therefore will arrive at its destination on the scheduled date. But observed reality says something rather different. And no amount of cunning spin or establishment rank closing or legal threats can ever possibly make it otherwise. Nurse's analogy does not work. However, because this, quote, cancer he and his fellow warmist have diagnosed is starting to look like nothing more serious than an ingrown toenail, do we really want to go through the misery of chemotherapy or surgery on the precautionary principle that at some unspecified future date, the toenail problem might suddenly metastasize into something deadlier? That's certainly where we are at the moment with regard to international policy on climate change. Billions, if not trillions of dollars, are being diverted into renewable energy schemes, decarbonization projects, biofuels, and such, like for no better reason than that for some while back, a bunch of scientists came up with a theory that anthropogenic CO2 posed a serious health risk to the planet. But since then, the science has moved on, just like it did with humors, and phlogiston, and eugenics, and all those other theories that were fashionable for a period, but which were eventually superseded by what Thomas Kuhn called a paradigm shift in scientific thinking. This is how true science works and how it always has worked. A scientific theory, Karl Popper argued, is only useful if it contains the key to its own destruction. That is, for a proposition to have any real scientific value, it must be falsifiable, capable of being proved wrong through experiment and observation, just like has happened to the once plausible but now thoroughly discredited theory of catastrophic anthropogenic global warming. You'd think a scientist of the caliber of Sir Paul Nurse, or indeed of Michael Mann, director of the Earth System Science Center at Penn State University, or Phil Jones, director of the Climatic Research Unit at the University of East Anglia, would be familiar with this kind of thing, but apparently not. Thank God for know-nothing English literature graduates and their pesky insistence on doing a bit of background reading, eh? Climate Change the Facts is published by Stockade Books. All rights reserved.